Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowy Institute. My name is Ewan Graham. I'm the director of the International Security Programme here. Today we're joined by Dr. James Cockayne, an Australian who has come back to Sydney, but has also gone on to many interesting walks of life and currently in his role at the United Nations University, oversees a variety of topics, but it will be here to talk to us today on an area that we frankly don't cover as much as we probably should, on the themes of transnational crime, which links both as a security issue, but also across our geographic areas of interest here at the Institute. The title of his talk is The Hidden Triumvirate, The State, The Mafia, and Legitimate Business. But James has published a book on this theme, which is just about to come out, The Strategic Logic of Organized Crime. And I understand there are some copies here available for anyone who's interested. They might want to approach James immediately after his talk. I've always been rather jealous of people with interesting surnames, and James, I think, is uniquely qualified. I'm sure you knew you were going to get a reference to that at some point, so I thought I would get it out of the way to talk on transnational crime issues. Ladies and gentlemen, James will stay on to take some questions in panel format afterwards. Please welcome Dr. James Cockayne.
Thanks, Ewan. Thanks so much, Ewan, for that lovely introduction. It's very nice to be back here in Sydney and at the Lowy Institute to see some friendly old faces from years past. It was kind of you, Ewan, also to call attention to my surname, so we got that out of the way. I guess if there's anybody to blame for that, it's not really me, but it's probably my mum and dad, so it's particularly nice to have my mother here. Thanks for coming, Mum. My sister is a doctor. She tells me that being Dr. Cockayne is actually much harder for her than it is for me. You can imagine what kind of walk-in she gets. But actually, I think the person who had it worst or best, depending on how you look at it, was our father, who, true story, was actually a professor at Oxford that taught undergraduate chemistry for a while. So in the first week, there would be huge numbers signing up to Professor Cockayne's chemistry class, but dropped off after a week or two after they realized it wasn't quite that kind of chemistry class. Ladies and gentlemen, as a way into this topic, I think it might be worth recounting a story that Jim Woolsey, the former director of the CIA, shared with the Banking Committee of the US House of Representatives in 1999. This was how the story went that he shared. He said, if you are in a restaurant in a high-end hotel on the banks of Lake Geneva, and you should come across a gentleman who introduces himself as the representative of a Russian trading company, and he's wearing a nice $3,000 suit and Gucci loafers, of course, then there are four possibilities. The first possibility is that he is exactly what he says he is. He's a representative of a Russian import-export company, and he'd like to form a joint venture with you. The second possibility is that, in fact, he is a representative of the Russian intelligence services working under commercial cover. The third possibility is that he is a representative of Russian organized crime. But the fourth possibility, Jim Woolsey said, and the most interesting one, is that, in fact, he is all of those things and all of those institutions are perfectly happy with that arrangement. Now, the reason that anecdote is revealing and telling is because it draws our attention to the fact that increasingly the methods of statecraft, organized crime, and to some extent legitimate business appear at times to resemble each other. Now, historically, analysts have tended to say that politics and organized crime are actually very separate things. But then we see things like this that make us laugh because they strip away that conventional thinking and make us reflect on the apparent similarities between the way that these different spheres of activity work. Political scientists and international affairs specialists have traditionally assumed that organized crime does not pursue political power. Instead, it pursues profit. So they've tended to bracket off organized crime and say that is not an area of activity we're particularly interested in, because organized crime, whatever is happening at the domestic level, doesn't have agency on the international stage. Criminologists, on the other hand, have looked closely at organized crime at the domestic level and found that in some circumstances, certain criminal groups do in fact seem to develop governmental or quasi-governmental power. But we haven't really done much at an analytical or empirical level to think about what the intersection of those two different perspectives might mean. What would it mean if a criminal group developed governmental power not only over illicit markets or marginalized populations, but also in the upper world, and used that power to extend its political influence even across borders? How would that upend or challenge our existing notions of strategy and international affairs? The reason we haven't really taken that hypothesis or possibility seriously is because we have tended to assume, as I said, that criminal groups do not seek power, they seek profits. But when you ask actors involved in organized crime, they don't necessarily see it quite that way. This is a gentleman called Francisco Manoia, who was a state's witness from the mafia in the early 1990s. He helped reveal the inner workings of the Sicilian mafia. And when he was asked about the reasons that he had joined Cosa Nostra, he had this to say. It's often believed that people work with the Cosa Nostra for the money, but that's only partly true. Do you know why I became a uomo d'onore, a man of respect, or a mafioso? Because before, I had been a nobody in Palermo. And then afterwards, wherever I went, heads bowed. You can't value that in money, he said. So although he was recognizing that participation in organized crime is in part about the pursuit of profit and wealth, he was saying that that's also bound up in that world with the pursuit of power. So in this book, Hidden Power, The Strategic Logic of Organized Crime, what I'm trying to grapple with is this possibility that in certain circumstances, criminal groups might pursue power not only in the underworld, but also in what we've traditionally called the upper world, and to try and understand what are the dynamics that govern that interaction, both at a conceptual and at an empirical level. And what I argue in the book is that in certain circumstances, rather than having two separate worlds, an upper world and an underworld, what we in fact see emerging is a single market for government. Now, this is where our understanding of business becomes particularly useful, because business management theorists have a lot to say about how organizations position themselves in those kinds of markets. And from that literature, we are able, in the book, to identify six different positioning strategies that it appears criminal groups have used historically to position themselves relative to political power. And what I want to do in the remainder of the time available today is to walk you through a number of stories that illustrate those different strategies, to give you a sense both of what's in the book, but also of how the relationships between criminal groups and political actors have played out and had an impact on the international stage. So I'll begin back in 1942 with this ship, the Normandy, which was the largest cruise liner of its day, a French vessel, as the name suggests. Early 1942, just after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and the United States has just entered the World War. The French, of course, were an enemy power, so the United States seized this vessel, which happened to be in New York at the time, and decided to retrofit it as a troop transport. It was going to be able to carry 10,000 troops to the European theater, the first American troops to enter the European theater. When disaster struck, the Normandy, or the Lafayette as she'd been renamed, was burnt to her hull and capsized at her berth on the western flank of Manhattan. This is about where 42nd, 43rd Street is now on Manhattan. This immediately created a sense of panic, not so much in the general public, but in the US intelligence services, because there was a concern that potentially this was a sign that there were saboteurs or even a fifth column operating in New York at the time that might actually have a very devastating effect on United States military capabilities. At the time, U-boats were wreaking havoc on merchant shipping in the North Atlantic, and there was a concern that Italian-American or German-American actors involved with the fishing fleet might be resupplying those U-boats. There had been a trial of German sympathizers in New York just a couple of months before, and it created great concern that maybe the fascist powers were creating a fifth column in New York. So the US government sent its agents down to the docks to try to gather intelligence about what had happened. But they were met with stony silence, because it turned out that it wasn't the US government that exercised governmental power and authority on the docks at that time. It was, in fact, the mafia. So the US government reached out to the mafia. They approached this guy, Meyer Lansky, a gangster who grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, alongside Lucky Luciano, a key mafia figure who at the time was sitting in a jail in upstate New York. And the reason we know about this engagement and everything I'm about to describe is because of an investigation undertaken at the behest of Tom Dewey. Tom Dewey was the district attorney who had put Lucky Luciano in jail back in 1936, but by 1942, he was the governor of New York. And at the end of the war, after the cooperation between the United States government and the mafia played out, it was to Tom Dewey that the difficult task of considering a possible pardon for Luciano because of his support for the United States war effort fell. So in order to understand exactly what had actually occurred, Dewey initiated a judicial inquiry led by an unimpeachable judge called William Herlands. And that inquiry undertook testimony from 54 mafia witnesses and from judicial officers. And it's the records of that judicial inquiry that sit in Dewey's archive in a very cold library in upstate New York in Rochester that tell us the truth of this collaboration. So what I'm about to recount to you is not hearsay or speculation. This is all documented in great detail under oath in this judicial inquiry. What happened was that the United States Navy worked with the district attorney to approach Luciano, and through Luciano got the authority they needed to go into the docks, to put informants and spies onto fishing fleet off the coast of the eastern seaboard, and worked with the mafia to undertake a number of activities that the government wasn't capable of undertaking on its own. That included intimidating labor, including an Australian labor activist that was over in New York at the time, beating him up when he was threatening to disrupt the war effort on the docks. It included intimidating the press, and it even included spotting and tracking down four Nazi saboteurs that were landed for their summer holidays in the Hamptons on the eastern end of Long Island in mid-1942. And for the legal scholars amongst you, it was the decision in the Supreme Court, ex parte Quirin, that allowed those particular Nazi saboteurs to be tried by a military commission and executed, that forms the basis for the Guantanamo Bay military commissions to this day. So what we see here is the first of what I describe as the six strategies that criminal groups take in positioning themselves relative to political power. The United States government wasn't able to reach into this space, the docks, and instead relied on a broker, an intermediary, the mafia, to do so. So this is an example of what I describe in the book as an intermediation strategy, a typical strategy for mafias, brokering between the state or political actors and populations or markets that the state is unable to reach. But this strategy didn't stop with domestic activity. It also extended to the mafia helping the United States government to project its power internationally during the war. including through helping the government with tactical and operational intelligence and connections in Sicily for planning the invasion of Sicily. In fact, when he was asked by the US Naval Intelligence where they should conduct their amphibious assault on Sicily, Lucky Luciano recommended a small town called Castellammare del Golfo. As you can see, probably not the best place for an amphibious assault. So why did he pick it? Well, he had long been in a feud in New York with a group that hailed from Castellammare del Golfo. So he probably thought it was a great place for the Allies to attack. It wasn't the only suggestion of his that the Allies fortunately turned down. We now know from my archival research that he actually volunteered to be parachuted into Sicily himself to make contact with the local mob bosses. That idea was actually taken all the way to Washington by US Naval Intelligence and only then turned down. When the Allies occupied Sicily, they realized fairly quickly that as they got rid of the fascist governing authorities, they didn't have much option but to turn to the mafia as the alternative form of governmental power on the island. And we have in the British National Archives two really very clear-sighted intelligence memos by a former consul in Palermo called Captain Scotton, who sets out for the Allies the three strategic options they have in dealing with the mafia. The first option, he says, is that the Allies could confront the mafia. But this is a bad option, he says, because we don't have enough policing assets. We only have about 14 Metropolitan Police bobbies on the island at the time. And even if we do round up 500 or 600 mafia bosses and inter them under questionable legitimacy and legality, that will probably have a pretty negative impact on the population's view of the mission. So some very interesting similarities start to emerge here in this memo between what happened in Sicily and more recent expeditionary activities by allies, for example, in Iraq, or indeed in the way that the United Nations deals with interventions during peace operations. The similarities being, for example, the limited access to policing capabilities and the difficulty in figuring out what to do with armed groups involved that are very heavily involved in organized crime. So the first option, confrontation, didn't look like a good option. The second option he pointed to was withdrawal. Essentially, he said the Allies could withdraw from parts of the island and leave it to the mafia to govern. But he suggests this is also probably not a good idea because it will send terrible strategic signals to our partners and to other actors during the Second World War. If we can't even govern an island like Sicily, why would they trust us to be a useful governing partner in the larger theatres that we're operating in? The third option, he suggests, is accommodation. We could reach a settlement with the mafia. But we know from watching where this memo went in the bureaucratic circuits that although it received attention at very senior levels, essentially the decision taken was not to take a decision. And it was left to local actors at the local level in Sicily to try to muddle through and figure out their own path forward. One of them in this small town, whose name you may recognize, decided actually to try to do deals with the local mafia bosses. And it was this kind of signal that convinced the mafia, the Sicilian mafia, that it had an opportunity to create political space. And here we see the mafia moving from that traditional first strategy of intermediation to what I describe in the book as a second strategy of separatism or autonomy. The mafia essentially mounted its own political movement and its own insurgency, pushing the cause of Sicilian separatism. The leaders of this separatist movement wrote directly both to Churchill and to Truman. They never received a reply. But they basically said, if you allow Sicily to secede from the Italian state, then we will guarantee you an effective strategic partner in the Mediterranean. They were using this strategy of pushing for a separate space that the mafia could control, that the criminal group could control, as a way to create leverage. And although they didn't follow through, it was through the leverage they created that they then got the best deal that was available from the political parties. We know that the mafia then went around the different political parties, starting with the communists, then moving on to the monarchists, and ultimately settling on the Christian Democrats, to do a deal to embed their own power in the political settlement that would follow. And that is really the basis for the political settlement in Italy that that lasted for almost five decades afterwards. Now, not every armed group adopting a criminal strategy in those circumstances was as successful. This famous guy, Salvatore Giuliano, who, as you can see, was a master of PR even back in his own day, was much less successful. He tried to adopt a similar strategy, but failed really ever to develop from what the analysts call a social bandit into having a fully developed criminal strategy, as I described it in the book, because he was unable to figure out how to manipulate the mafia in particular to his own ends. And he ended up dying at the hands of the mafia after committing a terrible massacre of leftist political activists on May Day in the 1940s. Where they were successful, though, in particular, was in Palermo. The mafia formed a very successful collaboration with the Christian Democrats in Palermo that brings us to what I describe in the book as the third strategy, the third positioning strategy that criminal groups adopt sometimes. This is what I call a merger or joint venture strategy. And in this strategy, the criminal group and the political actors vertically integrate their capabilities. Now, what I mean by that is that elements of the political organization or the state are used to develop criminal rents, and elements of the criminal organization are used to govern. In Palermo, this involved the integration of the Christian Democrat infrastructure with the mafia and the exploitation of the public purse at the cost of the physical environment in Palermo. By the late 1950s, Palermo was the largest consumer per capita of concrete anywhere in the world, as the Christian Democrats used their control of public infrastructure building to completely change the face of Palermo. And of course, it was mafia beneficiaries who got all the contracts. The problem with this kind of approach is that over time, it undermines the popular legitimacy and credibility of the governing elite. And the mafia learnt this the hard way in another place where they quite strategically pursued a joint venture with the ruling power, namely Cuba. In 1933, in the Waldorf Astoria, Lucky Luciano and Maya Lansky, it always seems to come back to them, sat with their cohorts and planned a mafia investment strategy in Cuba. And it rested on working with Fulgencio Batista, a young officer at the time, to develop a joint venture in the government of Cuba. And over the succeeding 20 years, that's exactly what they did, to the point that by the 1950s, Cuba's political economy was really focused on criminal activity. It even involved the use of a national development bank in Cuba to subsidize the creation of a tourist infrastructure that was owned and operated by combined New York mafia and Havana mafia interests. So what that meant was that mafia syndicates would invest in hotels and casinos, the construction of which was subsidized by the Cuban state, and the gambling, prostitution, drug trafficking rackets run through those hotels and casinos were also owned and operated by the syndicates of New York mafia and Havana mafia interests. As I said, the problem with this strategy, though, is that over time it undermines your credibility with the local population. And in fact, in Cuba, it not only undermined the legitimacy of the Batista government, it also undermined the military effectiveness of the Batista government. Increasingly, military posts were not based on merit appointments. They were rewards for bribery and corruption. And why were they rewards? Well, because being posted to a particular town meant that you could control the vice markets operating in that region. The local lottery, the local brothel, the drug trafficking running through that particular area. So increasingly, the Cuban military was not focused on military readiness and military effectiveness. It was focused on governing illicit markets. And that created space for insurgency. And it was Fidel Castro who exploited that space, moving from the East into Havana and effectively kicking the mafia out. Now, this is where the mafia moves to what I describe in the book as a fourth strategy. Pushed out of Cuba, the mafia moved with Batista's cohorts to Miami. And from Miami, they organized a series of transnational armed attacks on Cuba, terrorist attacks. These were attacks including aerial bombardment flown air sorties flown from the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico on civilian and commercial interests in Cuba, designed to foment civilian unrest and to depose Castro. What we thought historically was that it was the CIA which went to the mob to work together to try to create unrest in Cuba. But what we've learned from this archival research is that, in fact, the mafia already had its own international strategies in place and brought them to the CIA. They met, in fact, at this hotel in Miami, the Fontainebleau. Two CIA agents met with this trustworthy-looking gentleman, Sam Gold. They refer to him as Sam Gold in their internal documents, but we now know that that's in fact Sam Giancana, who was the head of the Chicago mob at the time and on the top 10 most wanted list of the FBI at the time that the CIA met with him at the Fontainebleau Hotel. And what they did was they passed to Sam and a couple of his associates botulinum pills, poison pills, for the mafia to pass on through its networks into Cuba to try to poison Castro. And this is just one example of the techniques that they used. They pursued a number of different stratagems with the mafia designed to try to assassinate Castro. What's interesting about this, as I said, though, is that we now know that it was the mafia that actually cooked up these schemes in the first place and brought them to the CIA and not the other way around. And that even extended to the mafia subsidizing and organizing governments in exile, for example, one led by a Cuban in exile, Tony Verona, and hiring K Street lobby firms to try to promote these groups as potential governments in waiting if Castro was removed. And this is very important from an analytical perspective because it shows us that in certain circumstances, some criminal groups do actually have international political strategies that they are executing on the international stage. The danger, of course, for a clandestine service like the CIA of working with a group like the mafia is that you can't be assured that they are, as your agents, being faithful to your strategic objectives. And this was something that was recognized both by Bobby Kennedy and when he came into office by Lyndon Johnson. When he found out about the collaboration between the CIA and the mafia, Johnson said simply, referring to the hit squad that the mafia had organized in New York in the 1930s, "We were running a murder inc. in the Caribbean." And the danger with this is that although you've lit the fuse on the bomb, you're not necessarily in control of when the bomb is going to go off and where, because the mafia has that control. So we now know, again, from the archival research undertaken for this book, that there were moments in both the Bay of Pigs invasion and during the Cuban Missile Crisis when the mafia's involvement almost derailed United States efforts. There is a particular moment during the famous 3 days in October when the Soviets and the United States are conducting back-channel negotiations to resolve the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the mafia and the CIA send one of their hit squads towards Cuba during the negotiations. Fortunately, the Kennedys found out about this and overrode the command, but there was the possibility of a very serious incident taking place as a result of this dalliance between the CIA and the mafia. Now, finally, we come to the sixth strategy. Despite all these designs and efforts, the mafia wasn't successful in forcing their way back into Cuba. So what do you do in that situation when you can't find your way back into a market that you've been pushed out of? You have to go and look for a new market. And in the book, I describe this using business management terminology as a blue ocean strategy, When a certain part of the ocean is running red with blood from your competitors, the best strategy may be to look for a part of the ocean that's clear, that's blue, sail off to that part of the ocean and create a new market. That's exactly what they did. First of all, they mounted an armed invasion of Haiti. That was also not very successful. So then they looked at other options, the Dominican Republic, and eventually they struck gold in the Bahamas, where they formed an alliance with the ruling elite to develop what we now know as casino capitalism, a system of intertwined interests between a local casino, political operators, and offshore banking that has now been picked up in many other places around the world. Also, what's interesting about this final case is that the mafia learned from its mistakes. Again, a sign that they are genuinely strategic actors. Whereas in Cuba, they had ignored the rising discontent around their cooperation with the elite, they didn't ignore it in the Bahamas. And when they saw that there was growing political opposition to the ruling white elite, instead of ignoring the opposition, they reached out to the opposition and they funded the election campaign of this gentleman, Sir Lyndon Pindling, the first black premier of the Bahamas. So when he came into power, he was more than happy to cooperate with the mafia going forward. And in fact, over the course of about three decades, he became in some ways even more corrupt than what we saw in Cuba, ending up giving over one of the islands of the Bahamas wholesale to Colombian cocaine traffickers as a depot for cocaine trafficking into the United States. So what do we learn from all these stories? Well, I think we learn several things. We learn that criminal groups can, in some circumstances, develop political strategies, and those strategies take a variety of forms. That they can involve influencing elections, stoking insurgencies and terrorism, making peace when necessary, and making war when necessary, if that's what is required to achieve their objectives. But what we also see is that increasingly, criminal groups learn to combine these strategies in different ways. And I want to, just in the couple of minutes left, jump forward to more contemporary circumstances. In Mexico at the moment, for example, we see, or not perhaps, the emergence of a range of different armed groups involved in organized crime, drawing legitimacy from multiple different sources and combining them into hybrids in very interesting ways. This is an image of a shrine belonging to, or a shrine to, in a sense, the Knights Templar, an offshoot of a group called La Familia, the family, in Mexico. As you can see from the iconography, this is a group that has bought wholesale into the imagery of the Knights Templar from the Middle Ages and combine both religious norms and military organization as a basis for the way their organization operates. But it is also an organized crime group. It's a group deeply involved in political corruption in the state where it operates, and it is a group that is heavily involved in drug trafficking and extortion. It's not only hybrids that we see. We also see some armed groups increasingly switching quickly between different types of strategies. In West Africa, you may have heard of this character, Mokhtar Belmokhtar. Now, as the image suggests, he is now a major operative for Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb in West Africa. But he was for a long time known as Mr. Marlborough because he was a leading figure in cigarette trafficking in West Africa. So what we're seeing here is that criminal groups are able to choose between different strategies, even arguably different ideological frameworks, to maximize their power depending on how they read the local strategic environment. Finally, the last thought I want to leave you with is that there may be circumstances in which it's not only non-state armed groups that are mixing and matching political and criminal strategies, it may also be some state groups that are mixing and matching political and criminal strategies. Increasingly, we see a convergence between the kinds of methodologies that the mafia developed in the Bahamas, for example, with offshore banking and its ties to junket capitalism, and the kinds of techniques that are used in some countries, particularly in countries espousing what is sometimes known as state capitalism, for ruling elites to take rents and profits out of the local economy and move them into global banking circuits. What that points to, I think, is a convergence at some level between political and criminal strategy that has very profound implications for the way the international system works, and that should give us pause in thinking about how power works at the international level. Increasingly, we see groups seeking to develop political influence without political responsibility. And that, at its essence, is the heart of criminal strategy. The power that criminal groups seek to wield is not the overt power of a political ruler, but the hidden power of a clandestine group seeking to achieve political outcomes without political accountability. Thank you very much.
That was fascinating. A grand Thank sweep you. And some great pictures and some very colourful characters along the route. You've already updated us at the final part of your talk. Just to get the discussion underway, maybe I could ask you just to shift the focus geographically a little bit closer. You are, after all, a Sydney-sizer coming back home. To what extent do these models and challenges apply in Australia's region, whether it's Southeast Asia or Pacific? And how does that or not feed back into Australia itself?
That's a great question. Obviously, Sydney, one of the monikers for Sydney is Sin City. There's a long and rich tradition of organised crime and connections between organised crime and political power in this city, actually. And even today, although I won't comment on the potential connections between organised crime and politics today, it's certainly very clear that organised crime is alive and well in this country. One of the things we learn from this study, I think, is that it's very easy in adopting a label like organised crime to assume that it is somebody else's problem, that it's the problem of the developing world or of marginalised populations, that it's not our problem. But we also see, given the locations that we were looking at in this discussion, that actually it's something that has been integral to the development of certainly power in the United States and arguably in other parts of the Western world as well. And that today, the way the global political economy works, it's very hard to disentangle the role of organized crime, for example, in Southeast Asia with global financial systems. You only have to look at the allegations, for example, around 1MDB to understand how events in Malaysia connect to investments in the United States, even in Hollywood, according to the allegations. So these things are very intertwined. In this region, we're surrounded by countries that are going, even now, through fairly sustained political economic transition. And it's often those transitions that create opportunities for local actors to develop the governmental power that forms the basis of the kind of political influence that we were looking at. There are, of course, in Southeast Asia, countries that have been through a very rapid economic transition over the last 20, 25 years. And there is fairly considerable evidence that in some of those countries, there are criminal networks that have developed that kind of power in those contexts.
Thank you. We have a little over 15 minutes for questions and comments from the audience. Could you just please identify yourself and keep your question as short and sharp as possible? There will be microphones coming round, so please just wait after you put your hand up and then ask your question, starting over there with the gentleman.
In terms of solutions to some of these problems, do you think there can be a bit more done on whether, say, the legislative front to at least curtail some of the opportunities for illicit ventures? So one example that's brought up in the Australian context, there are allegations of real estate, in this case, being used for money laundering and the like. And it's been, even though it's enjoyed bipartisan support, there's been a reluctance to actually legislate to really require more stringent requirements on the part of real estate agents and lawyers, for example. Do you think more can be done on that front?
But why don't we take two questions at a time? Who's got another to follow up? Nick Welsh from the Institute.
Yeah, Nick Welsh from the Institute, in case you didn't get that one. I've got a question. With the rise of cybercrime, obviously, has opened up a whole new avenue for this profit motivation that crime's always had. Would you say it's done the same for the pursuit of political power, though? And if so, how?
Great questions. On the first question, I think there's certainly a big push for improved regulation and discipline of financial intermediaries generally, whether it's real estate, accountants, lawyers, because there's a growing recognition that it's fine to have anti-money laundering rules for banks, but there are also other actors who participate in the financial system that might also be subject to the same kinds of pressures that have unfortunately led some banks in the past astray. I think that what that also raises, though, is an important point about the extent to which legislation and law, broadly understood, is an effective response to the kinds of things we've just been talking about. It's certainly effective regulation and legislation in economies and political systems like this one are necessary and a sine qua non of reducing the impact and the influence of organized crime. But in some of the places we're talking about, the legal system, the judiciary, is simply not sufficiently powerful for that to be a sufficient response. So what we're beginning to recognize at the international level, I work at the United Nations, so this is something we're increasingly thinking about, is that while law enforcement is a necessary response to crime, in some contexts where criminal groups also develop social and political power, we may need to be looking at other forms of response as well, going beyond law enforcement responses. And this is something fairly new. In particular, what's new is thinking about the fact that in some parts of the world, these groups are actually providing the governmental services that the state is not or cannot. And they may actually be providing quasi-public goods to people. So we have to grapple with that on its own terms. We have to recognize that these groups develop very real legitimacy from their ability to provide services and dispute resolution, to allocate resources, to provide norms, not only in these illicit markets, but to populations. We haven't really thought through effectively how we do that. And one of the key points I focus on in the book is that grappling with their legitimacy is absolutely key. We have to think about why these groups are legitimate, not just from a performance level, but how they deliberately cultivate the norms that give them legitimacy within local populations. In Mexico, for example, the cartels have subsidized and invested in a huge culture of narco ballads, and narco cultura, actually, it's called. So popular music, telenovelas, other things celebrating the criminal culture. And the danger with that is that it normalizes the power and mystique of these organizations. So it may be necessary for us to think about how, as governmental actors or intergovernmental actors, we tackle that legitimacy on its own terms, not through tools such as legislation and regulation, but through other tools. Now to the second question about cybersecurity and cyber warfare and what it has to do with political power and organized crime. There are certainly some interesting crossovers between the kinds of collaborations I look at in my book between clandestine services and organized crime and the kinds of things that we're allegedly seeing now with some state actors using private groups to engage in cyber activity, disruptive cyber activity. The best analyst, I think, the best theorist in this area is a guy called Thomas Ridd from King's College London. He has a great book called Cyber War Will Not Take Place. His argument essentially is that cyber war is not war as we have traditionally understood it. It's really cyber subversion. It's about subverting the strategic objectives and the strategies of your adversary, and that you do that through the use of cyber activity to disrupt their either their ability to execute their own designs or indeed to confound and confuse their constituents about what's actually reliable data. And certainly if you look at what's going on in the United States at the moment with the allegations around interference in the presidential election process, some of this seems to be playing out. Now, what does that have to do with organized crime? I think the answer is that the CIA learned the hard way that it's very hard to work with an actor like organized crime that in fact has its own strategic objectives, and to assume that it will necessarily carry out your strategic designs and that it will stop carrying out your strategic designs when you ask it to. So it's a very dangerous tool to work with. And I think if there are states that are working with organized criminal groups to carry out cyber subversion at this time, they may find that they learn that lesson also the hard way.
Take another couple of questions. Gentleman over that side.
Quo vadis. The question is, how do you define organized crime? If you take transfer pricing, and most large corporations have departments of solicitors and lawyers and everything else right, to try and interpret the regulations, but since they all go international, one interpretation in one constituency could be quite different from the other. So are these large corporations engaged in organized crime?
Well, there's two great questions there, but I think I'll stick to the first one. How do you define organized crime? There's various ways of looking at this, Ian. The short and glib answer is that organized crime is whatever states say it is. Now, that actually brings us to your second point, because often states say that things are criminal, but the way they define it is so complicated that it leaves a lot of gray area. I think where it leaves a grey area, the more interesting question to ask is, why does it leave a grey area? And we're back to the question from your neighbour about financial intermediaries and so on. Often it actually serves states' interests not to be too specific about these things for one reason or another. When they want to be, states tend to find ways to be rather specific. And most of the organised criminal activity that I look at in the book is activity that the vast majority of states have been very clear is organized criminal activity. Drug trafficking, human trafficking, extortion, arms trafficking, because those are activities that harm the vast majority of states' interests. So there is certainly an element of power involved in the definition of an activity as organized crime. We can't get away from that. And recognizing that defining something as criminal is in itself a political activity, is very important because it makes us recognize that actually states are often competitors with other sources of power the ability to project their norms onto the world around them.
You've also done a lot of work on peace operations, peace building operations. So maybe I just invite you to explore the linkage between post-conflict situations and the kinds of challenges that you've been talking about. Obviously, there's an overlap, but are there unique challenges that are thrown up in such situations that require a particular tool set at the international level?
It's a great question, Ewan. We're learning a lot about that. We've, again, unfortunately, learned the hard way over the last couple of decades through interventions in places like Kosovo, Haiti, Afghanistan. And what we're learning, unfortunately, is that in many cases, we've taken policy decisions, we've made policy choices that have not taken into account the ability of armed groups exiting conflict to transition into organized crime and to use the power that they generate through organized crime to influence the political system. So to give you a couple of examples, there's a strong preference traditionally in international interventions to transition very quickly to elections. It makes a lot of sense. You want to have a democratic source of legitimacy for the government of the territory or country as quickly as possible. The problem is that the people who have the street muscle and the money to finance election campaigns immediately exiting conflict tend to be the armed groups that were involved in trafficking or smuggling or other forms of organized crime. So what we've seen repeatedly is that those groups become the powers behind the throne through that election process and use the elections to launder their ill-gotten gains from conflict into influence in the post-conflict situation. Similarly, we have a vogue to localize governance in post-conflict situations, to drive governance down as close to the people as possible. Again, there's very good reasons to do this. You want to create as much and as strong democratic legitimacy as possible. The problem is, if you do that, we also know from federal systems like Australia or the United States that organized crime develops wherever policing and spending powers are exercised. So if you're driving governance out, away from Kabul, out to the different provinces of Afghanistan, you also need to be driving your anti-corruption spending out to those provinces. But from a donor's perspective, that looks like going from having one anti-corruption program to having multiple anti-corruption programs, which looks very, very expensive. So they have tended not to follow through with that, which of course leaves a gap and actually plays into the hands of actors that are trying to develop criminal influence at the local level. Now, we're learning slowly how to deal with that. There are cost-effective ways we can deal with that, for example, through having a strong anti-corruption program in the capital and then having randomized testing out in the provinces. But unfortunately, we're learning by doing. And what at the UN now and in other intergovernmental organizations, there's a big push to try to grapple more deliberately with the influence that criminal actors have in political economies, both during conflict and after conflict, so that we can be a bit smarter in our response and response designs.
That's a great response, but it puts me in mind of another wicked problem at the UN level, where sanctions are often seen as the tool of resort, where the UN does not have the benefit of a presence on the ground to do some of the things you've just been talking about, where at least it does have in a peace-building situation. But there are obvious risks in terms of encouraging the criminalization of an economy. One exactly. thinks of examples in Serbia and the former Yugoslavia. Do you think, maybe just comment in general about that, but is the UN also equipped to have these internal conversations between the different parts of the organization, that there is obviously a big political push for sanctions in certain circumstances? At what point is the risk entered into the decision-making process?
Again, great question. We have learnt, again, the hard way, how sanctions sometimes lead to criminalization. In retrospect, it's somewhat obvious that that would be the case. You sanction a country, it creates an incentive for the rulers to turn to professional smugglers and sanctions busters to do business, to try to figure out a way to keep the economy moving. Now, sanctions have changed considerably over the last 25 years. They've become more and more targeted, much smarter, as we've learned not to embargo whole economies, but to go after very specific individuals. But there's still evidence of this kind of criminalizing impact, that targeted individuals may be turning to fixers and what are actually called in the literature super fixers to try to find a way around the blocks that are put in their way on their travel, their access to luxury goods, their access to the global banking system, and so forth. In the UN, there is a disconnect between the way that sanctions are discussed and implemented and monitored in the Security Council and much of the other work of the UN system. It's an ongoing problem. It's something that actually the Australian government had a very positive impact on, leading a sanctions review while we were on the Security Council not so long ago. Many of the ideas in that review that Australia played such an important role in have been picked up, although they were blocked in the Security Council from formal adoption. They have nonetheless been picked up and actioned at the operational level. And we're starting to see a closer integration of political analysis and sanctions work. Also, the New Zealand mission currently on the Council has been integral in pushing that work forward. So there's a long way to go, I would say, but the more sensitive and nuanced we can be in understanding how armed groups use access to global criminal markets to develop their power, the better we will become at developing effective policy responses.
Great. Time for one quick question from the floor. I saw the gentleman at the end, your hand was up first. Sorry, sir.
Thanks very much. David Kinley from Sydney Law School. James, you've obviously looked at how criminal groups can merge with terrorist objectives, where they're viewing political strategy as much as gaining a buck. insofar as a criminal group does become more terrorist-oriented, would that change the way in which you would suggest one approaches that armed group?
Yes, great question, David. Lovely to see you here. There is a lot of thought going on in the UN about this right now, in part because of what we see going on with the Taliban in Afghanistan. There are very different schools of thought about what is going on in the Taliban. Some people believe that certain elements of the Taliban are becoming heavily criminalized. And what I mean by that is that their decision-making is increasingly determined not by political considerations or even military considerations, but by the desire to develop power over criminal economies, particularly around certain mines that are now becoming quite lucrative in Afghanistan. What we know from other cases, for example, in Colombia and in Northern Ireland, is that this creates great tension within a militant organization, because you have different factions that are essentially trying to pursue different strategies. And that actually creates an opportunity, of course, for an adversary to drive wedges, to split these organizations. But it can also mean that those organizations become more volatile, potentially more violent. So what it always comes down to is detailed analysis and information, intelligence really, about what's going on in the organization itself. And what that points to is a point that, coming back to the beginning of the discussion, that we have overlooked. These actors are agents in international affairs. They have the power to choose their own strategies and to switch between them. We've tended to treat organized crime as a structural phenomenon, something that emerges because there's gaps in governance or ungoverned spaces or vacuums. But the problem with that approach is it tells you nothing about dynamics. It doesn't explain when criminal strategies will be pursued or why, when they will lapse, when they will turn into political strategies. And for that, you need detailed knowledge of what's going on inside the group. There is no substitute, ultimately, for that kind of detailed analytical work.
Well, that's a great prompt on which, for us as a think tank, I think, to take our cue from you to include these questions in our own research agenda going forward. We are unfortunately at the end of our allotted time, but we'll hope that, James, you'll remain a friend of the Institute and that we will also be able in our way to contribute to some of the challenges and solutions to them that you've outlined in your work at the UN. Ladies and gentlemen, please show your appreciation for James Cockayne for a fascinating talk.
Thank you. Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.